Well, good evening, everyone. Welcome to Noir on the Radio. Tonight, I'm your production assistant, Pam Stack, and we are presenting Dames in the Dark with your host, Angel Colon. I'm going to turn it over right now to Angel, but first, let me tell you a little bit about him. He's one of the best noir crime fiction writers that it's been my pleasure to speak to. He's going to tell you all about his books, and he's also going to tell you about the Dames. Angel, take it away.
God damn, I feel nice. That made me feel special. I was dancing to the music. That was kind of fun.
Good
evening, folks. To preface this is the Dames in the Dark event at Noir on the Radio. Best thing I can say about this is Pam and I, we had a discussion, and you know, there's at times, surprising lack of women's presence in noir, and I know a few folks I've spoken to know that I am very vocal about my severe annoyance at that, and my at times fanboy-like glee with many of the women writers in noir and crime and mystery. I'm of the opinion that some of the best goddamn writing I'm seeing today is coming from women. That's not to short the dudes out there, but there are plenty of us, so we've got our chances. So tonight is dedicated to the ladies, that are writing some nightmarish and fucking crazy awesome shit. I'm absolutely thrilled to be doing this. Just to give you guys a heads up on who the fuck this guy is, my name is Angel Lewis Colon. I'm the author of The Fury of Blackie Jaguar. I'm also one of the editors of Shotgun Honey. We publish some of the best goddamn crime fiction you've ever read. You can check us out at shotgunhoney.com, I believe. I've also written for a bunch of different sites and magazines, Thuglit, All Due Respect, a bunch of random anthologies, and you can find some of my nonfiction work I've reviewed for the LA Review of Books, and predominantly My Bookish Ways. Other than that, if you've got a penchant to read a sperm bank robbery later this year, I've got a book called No Happy Endings coming out thanks to Down and Out. And I have a story appearing in an anthology that I'm really proud about called Unloaded. It's edited by Eric Beatner over on the West Coast. Really cool concept, crime writing without guns. So check that out when you can. I'm going to be
Angel,
opening up tonight
a,
with...
Angel, are you going to do some flash with this first? How about
I am. I'm actually...
You?
I'm going to open up with what I think is a pretty apt story. It's a story I had published in Shotgun Honey back in June of 2014, which feels like forever ago. It's called All Hail the Queen. So I think that's a pretty good title. All right. Here we go. She climbed into the truck's cab with a muffled sigh, the veiled mask over her head, shifting to the right. It wasn't a good fit. "We all set?" Craig grinned ear to ear. "In a sec," she raised a gloved finger. Craig drummed a beat on the steering wheel. "I'm telling you, I already got three farmers lined up. They'll pay through the teeth for this shit. With 100 hives, we'll be sitting pretty." Now she ignored him. She stared up at the full moon. Kept her right hand clenched. She felt like they were crawling all over her. "You okay?" "No." A knock on the back of the truck. Craig looked into the rear view and got a gloved thumbs up from Danny, the last-minute helper she insisted upon. Danny turned and made his way back to his Chevy. "You still mad at me?" Craig gave her shoulder a little pinch. "You'll feel better once we get paid." He leaned in. "Take off that stupid mask. You're like a fucking astronaut." "Not yet. The bees." She forced the words out. Her legs bounced up and down. "There ain't any bees in here." "Yes, there are." She turned and opened her right hand. She pressed it palm side up against his face and released a handful of honeybees she smuggled into the cab. A small cloud of gossamer-winged fury spread the life over him. She knew the facts, memorized all the essentials. Her grip already had them aggressive, bouncing attack pheromones in their prison in the event that there would be a chance to strike back. His initial yelp made them aware of his breath. Now he was a target. Craig batted at the air. "Jesus Christ!" It made the cloud more aggressive. There were stingers left behind on his cheek and brow, even one on his lip. That would make things worse. See, the stingers pumped venom in, but pumped pheromones out. Any bee still alive now had a singular purpose for the rest of their short, short lives. Kill Craig Bailey. He leaned over to the driver's side door and pulled the latch open. Spilled out to the ground in a thud, but couldn't muster the strength to stand, so he rolled over. She opened her door and climbed out, walked around the front of the truck and found him where he landed. His breathing was ragged and shallow, his hands up in the air, fingers swollen and reaching for nothing. When she was next to him and the cloud was only a straggler force of less than 10, she removed her beekeeper's veil and looked down on him. Craig's head looked fit to pop. His eyes were swollen shut and his lips were in a permanent cartoon pucker. She noticed they got his one cauliflower ear, not the size of a tennis ball. A few bees crawled over their conquered territory. She thought she even saw one emerge from a nostril. Craig wheezed. He grabbed at his neck. She leaned down and frowned. I ever tell you I was afraid of bees? Epi. Oh, this? She slipped the glove off and dug into his jeans pocket and took out his EpiPen. He nodded. The EpiPen was sent flying into the darkness. Yeah, no, I needed my cash back, asshole. I agreed to this after all that big talk you had about easy money. She kicked his left flank hard. He was too far gone to even react. But then you take me here, with the fucking bees. She mounted him and began to punch his fat blue face, took care to aim at the remaining bees of each hit, stopped when she realized he wasn't breathing anymore. Danny brushed her shoulder from behind. Regina, we gotta go. He helped her up. Motherfucker, she spit on Craig. I'll drive the truck, you take the car. Danny smoothed her hair. He kissed her lips. Okay. Regina walked to the Chevy. She heard the roar of the truck's engine coming to life, stripped off the rest of the beekeeping gear, and got into the car. 3 miles into the drive from the apiary, she noticed a lone honeybee crawling on her forearm. She flicked it out the window without a care. Thanks. All right, we're done with that one.
Wow. Wow. Cruel. I love it. Thanks, Angel.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Sweet. All right, so now let's get to the good stuff. Our first reader tonight is one of my personal favorite authors. First learned about her, I think it was All Due Respect, Issue 1, and Renee, you can actually correct me. She wrote a story called Amanda Will Be Fine, which to this day still fucks me up. So fucking kudos. We got Renee Asher Pickup here with us tonight. Renee Asher Pickup is a mellowed-out punk rocker living in Southern California. She's one of the senior editors over at Dirge Magazine. She's a class facilitator over at Lit Reactor and is one of the hosts of the Unprintable podcast. Renee writes fiction about bad things happening to flawed people and stands by the statement that From Dusk Till Dawn changed her life. Now, Renee, what are you reading tonight?
I'm reading a story called Holes I've Dug.
Awesome. All right, start when you want.
All right. Cool. I'm going to preface this by saying I read it out loud to my husband, and he said his response was that he's happy to know that I actually am not good at digging. So that's the preface for this story. If there's one thing I'm good at, it's digging holes. There's no bad situation I can't make worse. No small mistake I can't turn into a life-altering disaster. Once, I got an F in English. Before I realized I was digging, I had a bad reputation and 2 teachers had been fired on my account. Next thing I know, I'm expelled because putting someone's teeth into the roof of their mouth is looked down on, even if she did call me a whore. Didn't take long for me to figure out that whiskey made a fine shovel. Drink a little, dig a lot. Drink a lot, and those holes get so deep, so fast, I'd be ankle deep in mud before I realized what was going on. I turned into the kind of woman no one would hire at a respectable employer. The kind of woman who can't cut hair, can't really type, and has too foul a mouth to work retail. I worked construction until some cocksucker made a grab for my ass while I was carrying some lumber. Swung that board right into his face. That board may as well have been a shovel. This world doesn't have a place for women like me. This world likes women with clean mouths and clean fingernails. Women who politely charm the people they hate instead of setting their heels and digging in for a fight. I can't seem to help myself. Every time I turn around, I'm digging a new hole. Tonight, though, the squidge sound of my boots in the mud is very real. The splinters going through my hands from this old shovel are real. The whiskey on my breath is real. The blood? In a small town, you are who you are. There's no reinventing yourself, no turning over a new leaf. Everybody knows you fucked your English teacher, knocked out the prom queen's front teeth, and that you're the reason Earl's face will never be the same again. They know stuff about you that you never even did. No matter how bad I want to quit digging, I find myself here again. You know, I had an Amtrak ticket in my hand the night I met him, ready to leave this old shithole behind and go somewhere I had half a chance. Even had a job lined up. Oh, but there he was with the tight T-shirt and those fucking dimples, hands on my hips, telling me everything I wanted to hear. So I stayed. I woke up in his bed the next morning and ripped that train ticket into 100 pieces. So you tell me how I ended up digging this hole in the back end of his property, out here by the tree line, sweating and cursing. It wasn't the whiskey that put the devil in me this time, but it is making the job a little harder. I told him, you know, you can't have property this big, this far out of town, and not have a dog. Anyone could sneak right up and do anything, and you'd never see it coming until it was too late. I told him, you know, you better always be upfront with me. I'm not a jealous type. I'm not a dramatic type, but God damn, I hate a liar. I told him, you know, this sure is a pretty knife you gave me, and I'm going to carry it with me everywhere I go. I laughed and jabbed it at him, and I told him, you know, you could really hurt a man with a knife like this. I told him whiskey made me mean. I told him that bitch was flirting with him at the bar. I told him I was really fucking good at digging holes. I guess he knows now. And that's it. Woo!
Wow.
Nice.
I'm glad there's like an entire country between us, Renee.
That was a great ending.
That was fantastic. Yeah. Excellent. Very fun. So Renee, let's bother you a little bit. So I had mentioned Amanda Will Be Fine. That was in All Due Respect issue one, right? Am I misremembering that? Yeah, that was issue one, right?
That was definitely issue one.
Was it? Oh, okay. Awesome. I'm glad I'm not wrong. I remember picking that up and being like, holy fuck. Yeah. And any listeners and anybody else on the call, if you guys have not read that story, I cannot recommend it more. I don't know if All Due's still available on Amazon, but if it is, scoop that up. It's the entire collection is amazing, and Renee's story is the standout. It's fucking ridiculous. So, Renee, what have you got in the pipeline? What are you working on right now?
Actually, you know, what's really cool about doing this this show tonight is that I hadn't been doing a lot of fiction, so I wrote this story just for Dames in the Dark, because I've been focusing a lot on this kind of true crime thing I'm exploring at DIRD. So I've got a piece on Jodi Arraeus, which I don't know if you guys remember that case. It was like on HLN, like 24 hours a day, and it was all about like sex, basically. So yes. I'm in the final edits on a piece about how fucking crazy that case was, and how
that was Travis Alexander,
been...
right?
Yes, Travis.
Is that the guy
Alexander,
who got killed?
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's him. And they paint this whole thing like he's the sweet, innocent little Mormon boy, and she's like this sex-obsessed femme fatale, but then in court, it's all about all the weird sex shit that they liked, and it's like wild accusations, and it seems like they never even get to the actual evidence. So I'm writing a piece about that, and it should be coming out soon. And then I got a couple pieces of fiction I'm hoping to get submitted soon. So, you know, hopefully there'll be more fictional darkness coming from me as opposed to just the nonfiction kind.
The nonfiction kind. That tends to be worse sometimes, right? I mean, obviously. But with the Jodi Arraeus thing, is there anything interesting? Oh, I could imagine. Is there anything that from the Jodi Arraeus trial that you found interesting that most people didn't focus on beyond? You know, it sounds like there was probably a lot of kinky shit going on, but was there anything
that
nobody really focused on?
So I watched the majority of the trial in preparation for this article, and For one thing, I realized right away, I can't understand how anybody watched it. It was so boring. Nobody involved in this case had any charisma. But it was, what was weird to me was how in the beginning, you know, it's the prosecution building their case, and they're talking so much about her sex life. And at one point they showed just a spreadsheet of her vagina and anus, just devoid of context. Just, hey, here it is. Here's her vagina. That's obviously evidence.
Well, that's how you know she killed him.
Right. Yeah. And so I was horrified because I'm like, you know, I get it. Like, sure, she's admitted to killing him at this point. So, like, obviously she's the bad guy in the situation. But whoa. And then what was interesting is when it flipped and it was the defense, you realize the reason why they weren't just constantly objecting to all of this sex stuff is because their plan was to just pile on, oh, he's into BDSM, he jerks off to pictures of little boys, he sent a dick pic to her one time. Like, it's so wild. But also,
I gotta read more into that.
The lawyers are just terrible.
Wow. I need to look into more. I'm looking forward to reading the piece. And I pulled it up on Wikipedia real quick, and a random awful factoid at the end of this thing was apparently the director of the TV movie that aired on the Lifetime Network for Jodi Arraeus, Dirty Little Secret, a guy by the name of Jace Alexander, looks like he was just arrested and just pleaded guilty to promoting sexual performance with kids. So figures...
Whoa!
Nice, yeah. There's a little add-on for you if you want to add that to the article. Apparently, people who are talking about this. Wow. Yeah, this guy directed the movie. Horrifying. People are fucked up.
The movie was terrible, by the way. Don't watch it.
Yeah.
Don't.
Not surprised.
I get that, too. It was a bad idea.
Fun times. I can imagine. Well, thanks, Renee. Thanks for coming on. Fantastic story. Stay on, and hopefully a few people will call in with some questions. And we'll move on to our next reader. Carmen Jaramillo. Did I say that right?
That is absolutely right,
Carmen?
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, I was a little worried about that because I know I get pissed off when people screw up my name. Anyway, Carmen Jaramillo.
No, it's okay. I've had it said like so many different ways, so it's totally fine however people want to say it. So, yeah.
Excellent.
Thank you, though.
Anytime. Carmen actually had a story published over Shotgun Honey, I think last year, called Gota de Agua, which was one of my favorites of last year. It was a lot of fun, and one of the reasons why I asked her on. She's who I'm considering at this point one of the up-and-comers on the scene. I like her style a lot. Really cool, dark sense of humor. To tell you guys a little more about her, Carmen Jaramillo, was Minnesota-born, half-Panamanian pulp writer. Her stories about women behaving badly have appeared at the Flash Fiction Offensive, another favorite site of mine, Crime Factory Magazine, the aforementioned Shotgun Honey, and Acacia Books' Mondays Are Murder web series. She lives in Chicago and currently works on a novel, which is always a lot of fun. Carmen, what are you reading for us tonight?
I am reading a piece that I wrote specifically for this podcast. It is called Bad Intel.
Sweet. Let's hear it.
All right, thank you. I parked the dune buggy near the edge of a little rocky gully somewhere south of Zabriskie Point. I'd driven us about 10 miles off the highway into that scorched, roofless blister of salt and rock deep in the Mojave Desert. 500 million years of sun, wind, water, and drifting tectonic plates formed this place, every butte and ravine. One day the fault lines would cause an earthquake, something massive enough to rock L.A., and no poor sap will be able to stop it. And I know a thing or two about what a poor sap can't stop. In the passenger seat, Ben Jepson kept guzzling the drink I'd mixed up in my hotel room for him. I poured it into a thermos, keeping it cool while I drove us out. He's a better-looking guy than I expected, and that bomber jacket with the red and black patch sure suited him. Even the schlubbiest knuckle-dragger looks like Steve McQueen in one of those, even in the 70-degree March heat. He sauntered up to me in my jacket. He sauntered up to me jacket first when he saw me side-eyeing him in the diner in town. When I invited him to my room for a drink, I told him how I liked it. Then again, when I changed my mind and wanted to drive us out to a remote place in the desert. He slithered to the side to stare at me and grin, leaning against the dune buggy seat. So, you promised you'd tell me why you got run out of your hometown once we got out here. I shrugged. Bad intel. He clicked his tongue. Took the blame for something, huh? That shit sucks. It was true. Bad intel about me wouldn't stop spreading, especially not after the media got a hold of it. After that, the name Lourdes Los Santos would stay a suspect long after the cops cleared me. The rumor spread and stuck until I lost my job, my friends, everything I had. Just over the peaks, I could see Badwater Basin. It used to be a massive lake, 80 miles long of fresh water. Now it was sand, just a few mangy pools of salted slurry. Nobody could stop 500 million years of evaporation. Yeah, you know, stories spread. You just can't do anything. Who would they think it did? Does 309 Garfield Avenue in Minneapolis mean anything to you? He shook his head. Well, I used to manage that building. Last year, someone tried to break in, mangled a gas line. It leaked a day and a half. Well, you know, just one spark, and then seven people are dead. The cops didn't find the guy who tried to break in. Ben Jepson whistled, his eyes wide. Well, brutal. I stared over the hills and the bare rock. Wind and rain carved it out a little more every day. They always would. More slopes would form, pushed up from the faults in the earth. The gas explosion had been brutal. When the seven people are dead and half the buildings vaporized, the survivors want to blame somebody. Okay, I told you. Now you tell me. Why are you out here? Me? Well, he chuckled a bit and drank again, pulling on his t-shirt collar. I kind of stole some things. Why are you out here, then, if you got money? I wouldn't say I got money. My buddy Ryan, we teamed up maybe a year ago. He has all the ideas. I follow his lead. He keeps the money, mostly. We're laying low in town until it cools off, you know? You're lying to me, Ben. His face contorted. He tried to say something, but I only heard a croak in his throat. You've got all that money, don't you, Ben? You're the idea man. You plan everything. And you busted the gas line in my building. He grabbed his throat and dropped the thermos. He sucked in breath with his tongue wagging out. 7 people died because of you. He couldn't speak. He let out panicky gurgles and rattled his head back and forth, writhing, trying to lie, begging me to help him. I grabbed the sleeve of his jacket. You know the only lead the cops had besides me? A guy in a bomber jacket with a red and black patch. I used every last quarter I had to find that guy, the chief of a couple of currency exchange robbers, they told me. He wears it. That's you, Ben Jepson. They blame me for killing those people, you son of a bitch. He fell backwards out of the dune buggy into the gravel, his last croak muffled under a red froth coming out of his mouth. I hopped over the spilled drug drink and crouched next to Ben's carcass. I pulled out his phone and the keys to his apartment. Ben had lied. He kept the money. I'd use it to start over. Times I'd thought of giving the money over to all the families, the poor folks who died in that building. I still could, but they'd all been so quick to believe bad information, I didn't feel all that generous anymore. I had to plan this so carefully. I couldn't move in on the partner first to get him out of the way. If anything happened to one, the other would spook and bolt with all the money. I may never find him again. I swung the keys around in my fingers and browsed through the phone. In a minute, I'd drive off and leave him to slowly disintegrate in the heat, joining the layers of rock. I stopped breathing when I read an old text from about a month after the explosion. From Ben to Ryan. Dude, I'm bringing a girl over. This jacket is gold. I will buy it from you. And below that, Ryan agreed to sell. I understood what Ben had tried to tell me while he choked. It's not my jacket, Lourdes. You want Ryan. You believe some bad intel. I dropped the phone and it hadn't hit the ground before I started screaming.
Wow.
That's it.
Very nice. Nice. Wow. I like that ending.
Hey.
Yeah.
Nice.
Wow.
Very good.
Wow.
I started to think when I heard yours and then Renee's piece, I was like, oh man, is there the theme emerging here?
Yeah.
Wow.
Keep killing people.
You guys are the dames in the dark, man, and I'm like so glad I live in Southwest Florida away from all of you.
See, I just moved from the Mojave Desert, so I'm getting goosebumps over here from that one.
Oh, yeah.
That was great, Carmen. Carmen, you know, you're I wouldn't say you're like super new, but you're kind of new to the scene. I would like to know what attracted you to crime fiction noir. What drew you to this kind of subject matter?
Oh boy, that's a good question. I mean, I've liked reading mysteries most of my whole life. Like, one of the things that helped me learn to read were like the Boxcar Children books. So I've been reading mysteries for years. Like, I read all this, like, Sherlock Holmes stuff, and I started reading Raymond Chandler, I think, when I was in college, like, early in college. And I liked him, but didn't do a whole lot with it. And then after I had finished college, I, like, had all of this time to do, like, whatever I wanted, basically, for the first time in my life. So I'm like, oh, okay, well, what am I going to do now? And I kind of got back into reading Chandler, and I read James Ellroy for the first time, and I read some Dashiell Hammett and kind of moved on from there. And I've always just, like, always been writing too. I don't know, I just, for some reason, I was just like, you know what, I really do like this noir stuff. So I started like watching movies and kind of learning a little bit more about the history of the genre, and so the interplay between cinema and books. Just kind of one day started looking around for what kind of community was out there. So yeah, I'm still pretty new, I think, compared to a lot of the people who are reading tonight. So it's pretty fun.
You're finding a bunch of psychopaths, what you found. No, this is a great tribe, and no, that was fantastic. And keep it up. From what I've read from you has been fantastic, dude.
Oh man, thank you. I appreciate you guys having me on here too. Really appreciate it.
Hell yeah, man. It's been fantastic. And hey, if Elroy's the one that corrupted you, I recommend some Ted Lewis if you haven't gotten to read him. He's the fellow who wrote Get Carter. If you ever heard of the Michael Caine film, we will not discuss the Sylvester Stallone remake. But there was the Michael Caine film Get Carter. Ted Lewis was a British fellow. He wrote in the late '60s. Wrote Get Carter, the two other Jack Carter novels, as well as I think the recently released. I think it was last year. Soho put out GBH, Gross Bodily Harm, which is unbelievable. You may dig that. It's a little, It lives up to its name. but it's good times. Do you have anything in the works? Anything coming out soon?
I'm working on like a short piece right now. I've been working on a novel on and off for a while now, a couple of years, maybe. Like, I'll do 2 months of that and then take a break and do 2 months of a short piece. So I'm like kind of juggling both right now, I guess.
Yeah, that's always fun. There's always something else to do. There's always like a project that pops up, right? That
yeah,
kind of, like,
yeah. I have like
ADD.
My Google Docs has like 12 pieces of stories that I'll go back to at some point when I need.
Yeah,
I need an idea,
it gets pathetic.
So.
I think I have like, I literally have like 35 things that I just started to begin to finish. It's pathetic.
Yeah, yeah.
so,
having the ideas
awesome,
is the easy
dude.
Part.
And
the hard part is making the story.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I have ideas all day. It's terrible, but
yeah.
No, keep it up. And hey, if you've got anything new for Shotgun,
thank
shoot
you.
It our way. We'll take a look at it. Thank you so much
thank
for reading
you.
And thank you for joining us. All right, stay on and hopefully we'll get some questions.
It.
Awesome.
Sure.
Okay. Up next. We will be putting Nikki Dolson under the spotlight. Nikki first came to my attention. She had a piece published in Thuglit, which was fan-fucking-tastic. Folks in the scene know Thuglit is not only one of the most revered anthology books going out there, but is also a pain in the ass to get included in, thanks to the editorial eye of one Todd Robinson, the most magnificently bearded bastard in all of New York City. Nikki, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
All right, awesome. To introduce Nikki, Nikki Dolson's fiction has appeared and is forthcoming, in Day One, Thuglit, as I mentioned, Betty Fedora, which is an awesome, awesome, awesome new mag that's been popping. I think they're at issue 2. Thoroughly, thoroughly, thoroughly recommend. And Bartleby Snopes. She occasionally tweets at Nikki Dolson and tumbles over at NikkiDolson.com. Nikki, what are you reading for us tonight?
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm reading a story called I Am the Mistress.
Sweet. All right. Let's hear it, Nikki.
All right. I am the mistress. See me lurk in the near dark. See that man walking into the suburban dollhouse. The guy in the good suit with the well-trimmed beard that is softer than you can imagine, he used to be mine. He hasn't seen me yet. I'm parked a half block down the street. If he were to look this way, though, he would recognize me. I'm not in a wig or dressed in cat burglar black, head tucked in a balaclava. I'm in a dress he likes, a vintage blue gingham dress with petticoat. The gun, a Beretta subcompact, a gift from a different boyfriend, is in my handbag. The only concessions I've made to my task are the kitten heels I'm wearing, and they have bows on the back. I check my lipstick and hair in the visor mirror and smile. If I get caught, I'm going to look good for my mugshot. See the mistress kill time by swiping left on the dating app she met Mr. Adulterer on. Short men, fat men, tall men, left, left, left. Men hugging women in their profile pics, couples looking for thirds, men wanting relationships, but still listing casual sex under wants. Left, left, left. Mr. Adulterer's profile had none of these things. It was only two pictures of him showing off his sweet smile and intense gaze. I got chills looking at his picture. You're beautiful, he wrote to me. Gorgeous lips. I would like to do things to you. But first, you should let me buy you dinner. I did. Then I let him take me to his hotel room where he unzipped my vintage blue dress and contorted me in all the best ways. He is a talker, and it was how he spoke to me, his voice low and smooth, that did me in. I felt the reverberation of his voice in me for days after. He severed contact with me 3 weeks ago. It's full dark now. His street is empty. All the luxury vehicles snug in their garages. Teacup dogs and the wives who own them all drugged for the night. Often we met at his house. Glorious afternoons spent in each other's company, thrilled by the possibilities his neighbors might see us. Sometimes we met in hotel rooms on the Las Vegas Strip. Rarely, we met at my apartment downtown. He didn't like my place. It's too something. It's too me, he means. All my dresses and heels and pin-up girl style. I should have known he was preparing to end things. I am the mistress. See me make to his house. Peek through the windows and gaze into darkened rooms. His is a dollhouse of perfection. Everything just so. But a doll is missing. I have not seen his wife today. I wonder if she left him. She did sound upset when I called her this morning. Upset, but not surprised. All that matters is that he's home alone now. I am the mistress. See me jimmy the half-broken lock on the sliding glass door. The house doesn't have an alarm. Mr. Adulterer didn't see the point. He said, my neighborhood's safe. He didn't fix the lock because his wife nagged him about it. As soon as she stopped, I'll fix it. 15 years of marriage, you'd think she'd know me. She doesn't get me at all, baby. Not like you do. Then he pushed me to my knees. Mr. Adulterer likes his mistress on her knees. I wonder how much time the doll has spent on her knees in her perfectly appointed home. Did the cold seeping up from the tiled kitchen floor make her knees ache like it had mine? I wonder how he will look on his knees. I am the mistress. See me move silently room to room on a path of artfully strewn rugs. I loop the kitchen twice and run fingers down the marble counters. I caress the stainless steel appliances. I peek at the laundry room. I wonder about the stack of half-folded towels. I decided doll has left him. I nearly giggle but refrain. I wonder what he will say to me when he sees me. I stop in the dining room and admire the cherry wood table with its 8-place settings. Hundreds of dinners were eaten here while adulterer and doll feigned happiness. I hear a noise and press myself against the china cabinet, purse clutched to my chest. I hold my breath and listen. Again, the sound. Panting? Like someone exercising, maybe? Mr. Adulterer suddenly worried about the extra pounds? Or perhaps he's found a new playmate. I think of the last his last message to me after I begged to know why we were over. He wrote, it was just sex, baby, and you look like you could use the attention. I can't wait to give him some attention. I pull the Beretta and move quickly towards the living room. The noise stops, and so do I. It's dark except for the television, which is on but muted. The back of his favorite chair is before me. His hand dangles off one side. I step onto the hardwood floor. My footsteps are loud, but he doesn't say a thing. Hello, love, I say as I walk around the chair, then stop. She rises from her knees, leaving the knife where it is, protruding from his belly. I am the mistress, come face to face with the doll. The television bathes us in awful light. She is speckled with blood from pale face to bare feet. Her ballerina bun is perfectly messy. She folds her arms over her chest. You won't need that, she says, eyeing my gun. I look at him. If I ignore the blood, he looks like he's sleeping. I wonder why I don't feel sad. I guess not, I say. The wife reaches out and pats my shoulder. Her finger is still slick with blood. Let's have a drink. The end.
Woo. A lot of fun, Nikki. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. That was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that. I'm glad I'm on mute when you guys are reading because I was laughing a few times. Would have been really pathetic, but
it was excellent. I hope it gives men pause if they're going to think of the mistress. You never know.
Always. Oh, Nikki, thank you so much for joining us. Now you're another person I chose on account of being fairly new. You've had a couple of pubs, and like I said before, pretty impressive pubs like Thuglit. So I'll ask the same question I asked Carmen. What drew you to this genre? Is it something that you've always enjoyed, or is it something that you kind of just found out about and like, hey, I can write some really screwed up crap and actually make it good and make it fun.
I have always loved mysteries. I think it's like 10 years ago when I really started to focus on writing, and just the things that drew my attention were mysteries and crime fiction. After I discovered Ken Bruin, I just, you know, it was less mystery than, you know, the screwed up people who are doing things. Maybe they're not the bad guy, but they're really sad, you know.
So yeah, Bruin keys in onto that beautifully.
Yes, yes. And just from there, just read everything I get my hands on, you know, from Elmore Leonard, Elroy, got so many. Just really informed my fiction. And then suddenly I realized that I always had a body in my story somehow. There was always a body.
It's a little bit of like a Freudian slips. Yeah, there's still something going on.
I know, there's no real body. Well, okay, I won't tell you, but you know,
you don't have to. On Noir on the Radio, it's not necessarily a confession, so don't worry.
All right.
Do you have anything coming up that you're excited about? Anything you're working on?
In the immediate future, no. Though next year, my first book will be coming out, so I'm super excited.
Sweet.
About that. It's with 280
what,
steps.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Tentatively.
What's the name
titled
of the book?
All Things Violent. So
good.
It's yes. So about my contract killer with boyfriend problems. That's what it's about. Yeah.
Nice. And what is that coming out later this year?
It'll be spring of next year, is what I understand.
Spring of next year.
So yeah.
Badass. Congratulations on that. I'm really
Thank
happy
you
to
so
hear
much.
That.
Yeah.
280 Steps have been putting out some really cool stuff.
They do.
Are you looking forward? They've been doing some really cool covers. Are you looking forward to seeing what they give you?
Oh,
they get sorted out for you?
I'm so excited. That was just a huge, you know, selling point for me. I'm like, no, I'm in. That's an excellent cover. Make mine look that good.
I know, right? When you get that first snag, you're like, I kind of want a cool cover, man. This is,
yes.
Make it, come on, dude.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
We're not supposed to care about that. It's the covers are really cool. But that's fantastic.
Yes.
Congratulations. I look forward to reading it.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, thanks so much, Nikki. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break right now for Pam to give us a copyright announcement and give
the
phone number for our callers.
Thank you, Angel. Boy, those are some killer dames. The femme fatales here are making me nervous. So excellent reading so far. Really, really great flash fiction. Congratulations, dames. I wanted to remind everyone that this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. If you're interested in calling in and talking to our dames in the dark and our host, Angel Luis Colon, please do, but wait, because we have three more dames who are going to read. But take down the number right now to call in and say hello to the dames. Tell us about your own love of noir crime fiction or why you don't like it. 347, I can't believe anybody doesn't like it. 347-633-9609. And just a heads up, for all of you crime fic lovers, tomorrow night on Skid Row Chatter, the incredible Joe R. Lansdale joins Tom Pitts on Skid Row Chatter at 9 o'clock Eastern, 6 o'clock Pacific Time. So that's Skid Row Chatter with host Tom Pitts. Angel, back to you, and thank you.
Thanks, ma'am. And tomorrow's going to be awesome. I actually just finished Honky Tonk Samurai.
Honky Tonk, you did. Yeah, I just got the mail today, so I have to read
thoroughly enjoyed it.
He's
fantastic. Oh, Lansdale's voice is amazing.
Let me tell you something. He was on NPR last week, and he told some of the funniest damn stories I've ever heard because he's got that Texas twang. But, you know, it's interesting that Wednesday night is the premiere on Sundance of his new show for Happy Leonard.
Exactly, yeah.
So it's going to be a killer night. Big night for Tom Pitts, and I'm proud of him. I'm proud to be his producer.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Lansdale always had my heart since Bubba Hotep. I read that when I was in high school, and I love that movie.
Absolutely.
All right.
Absolutely.
Let's see here, guys. We're going to be moving on. I just want to pull up my list of your bios so I don't make an ass out of myself. Up next, we have Heather Luby. Now, Heather is a girl from the dirt roads of the Ozark Mountains. Her fiction has appeared or is forthcoming in Shotgun Honey, Manslaughter Review, JMWW, Bartleby Snopes, Word Riot, and several other places. She is the former managing editor of Flash Publication, the Citroen Review, and current instructor with the St. Louis Writers Workshop. Heather has an MFA in creative writing from Antioch University, Los Angeles, and her novel, Laws of Motion, is represented by Branton Hockman Literary Agents. When not conversing with the dark characters of her imagination, she can be found drinking coffee and reading comic books in St. Louis, Missouri. Heather, welcome to Dames in the Dark.
Hey, how are you tonight, Angel?
Doing fantastic. What are you reading for us?
I actually thought I would go ahead and read the piece that Shotgun Honey was kind enough to publish back in June of 2015. It's called
Awesome.
Everybody's
Awesome.
Got a Price.
Excellent. It's one of my favorites of last year as well.
I think I should preface that I think I'm the first lady tonight that'll be reading a piece from a male point of view. So,
right. Let it rip, Heather. Let's do it.
Yeah? Okay. I went to Galena to kill a 417 whore I'd never met for an even grand. That's how I knew I loved my girl. My girl JoJo demands a price that guys like me line up to pay. Wirt said the job would pay me enough to buy a ring, and a ring buys a future. What he didn't say was having me silence his side piece of speaker ass was buying him a future, too. I didn't have to break down her door. A layer of ex-football fat hides a pistol real easy under a coat, and I got a smile even Granny's love, sweet like those hard candies they like to suck. I gave the whore a good chubby boy smile, and she opened the door wide. The pistol grip slick with sweat and waiting. JoJo's lipstick kiss still wet on my neck. There's a saying, best laid plans and shit. I got the shit part. Blood in my mouth, maybe mine, maybe not, and never enough spit to mask the metal of it. 5 miles of no-shoulder country roads swerving in front of my headlights until I made it back to Wirt's place. Wirt took the gun from me, said, get your shit together. He wiped the butt of the gun off with his shirt, the blood mixing with the oily black stains from his grease monkey job. He tucked it into his waistband and gave me directions with his eyes. Sit the fuck down. I sat on the stool at his kitchen counter. He snapped his fingers at his most recent investment, and she handed him a bottle of Jack. Close your eyes. It stung like hell when he poured it over my head, but I didn't flinch. Stupid fucking grunt. Wirt slid 2 perks across the counter to me. I tried to look at her through the sting and decide if I thought she was worth killing over. She ain't no JoJo. Any other fuck-ups you need to tell me about? I felt the needle push into my scalp and pull out again. I tried not to think about what dirty piece of shit thread he was using to stitch me up. No, I said. Good. Wirt's replacement whore waited for me to chase down the pills before she took the bottle back to the couch. The honeymooners flickering from a rabbit-eared TV, each frame lighting up a different part of her pale jailbait skin. He broke the thread with his teeth and pushed me from the chair. 2 weeks and I better not see you before. At 3 a.m., I didn't worry about nobody seeing me around. JoJo would be waiting for me across town, pacing or passed out one, but I drove to the place of her pretty painted mouth anyway. $1,000. That's the price of a person. Doesn't matter if you're a dead one or the one making them dead. It only matters who's paying. This time it was Wirt, but I ain't stupid. Next time maybe he finances my expiration date. I put my hands in my pockets, rubbing the gritty bills between my fingers. The cash felt like a destination, like a lot of better decisions I could finally pay for. But I got kids to feed. That's what that hot rolling bitch kept shouting before I knocked her in the teeth with the butt of my gun. Then she didn't say nothing, just gurgled her own blood and spit, her pupils, big black mirrors. I didn't see the other fucking head. Didn't know she wasn't alone. I got the stitches to prove it, the no extra cash. Word don't pay for no one he didn't order. You're supposed to treat a girl like she's something special. Huh. The JoJo ain't of talking about other girls. I'll stay out of sight for a few weeks. Give my cash to a guy who's got a big-ass diamond from the Jew's jewelry box down in Clearwater. He's just been waiting for the right kind of buyer. I'm bought in. $1,000. The price of a person, whether you're killing them or trying to keep them. That's it.
Awesome. Thank you, Heather.
You're welcome.
And can I tell you, when I first read this before we accepted it, the wad of better decisions made me furious at how much I enjoyed that, and I was like, "Why didn't if I could write that?" That I was furious when I read that. Just so you know.
That's actually great to know.
I was like, "God damn you!" but thank you so much for joining us, Heather. Quick, you had mentioned you wrote this from the perspective of guy, and I love jumping perspectives, and I guess the question I have for you: do you find that difficult, or is it something that you know it's more fun that you can play around with and see if you could subvert some of the standard BS we tend to hear when we kind of stick in our quote-unquote lane?
Oddly enough, I write almost exclusively from a male point of view. My novel that's at market right now with my agent is in a male point of view. And I want to say everything to date that I've published except maybe one piece has actually also been in a male point of view.
So do you find yourself you just drawn that way, or is that something that you're consciously doing?
I think I'm sort of drawn into it naturally. I'm currently working on a second novel right now, and I'm trying to write it from a third-person point of view, but kind of a close perspective from a female character, and I'm actually finding it more difficult. Just because it's out of the norm of what I guess I have been writing for the last, say, 6 to 8 years.
Yeah. But you know what? Those challenges are welcome sometimes, I think, right? You can kind of do something a little different. And you scream at your screen, but, you know, you can hash something on. I think it helps you. You know, at the end of the day, you kind of go back into your mode, and you're like, oh, okay, this feels a little easier, and I'm kind of thankful that I have a place I can hide away in, but at the same time kind of stretch those muscles.
I'm super impressed by the ladies that have read so far tonight, and I'm feeling very motivated to try my hand at a little femme fatale.
Nice. That is the entire point of these things. I've found that most of the noir at the bars I've done and I've been to, they get me raring. So I'm hoping that's the case for everybody on the call now. I'm hoping that's the case for the folks listening in. This is our tribe. We got to share those creative juices, folks.
I love sharing juices with strangers.
Ba-dum-dum. All right, Heather, thank you so much. We're going to move on to our next reader, Rios de la Luz. Rios de la Luz is the author of the short story collection, The Pulse Between Dimensions in the Desert, that is sitting on my desk that I haven't gotten around to. I'm sorry. That's via Lady Box Books. Her work has been featured in Volume 1, Brooklyn, Entropy, World Literature Today, and Saint Susia, which is one of my favorite names for anything I've ever heard in my life. just... Wait, one quick story. Rios read a story, I think it was last year at Noir at the Bar in New York when you and Dave came over and blew me the fuck away. So I'm really excited to have her on tonight. Rios, what are you reading for us?
I'm reading a piece called Temple Politics. And then just FYI, everyone, I'm working on right now, like 4 hours of sleep. I flew from Oklahoma to Portland today, so I'm a little loopy, but I'm so happy to be here.
It's the best time.
Thanks for having
me on. A story.
Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you. Go for it, Rios. We're ready.
Alrighty. During Penelope's childhood, on unannounced days, her mama left her with some cash and instructions for surviving life alone. First, Don't trust any pendejos out there. They will all lie to you. Second, drink plenty of water. Third, go to school. If anyone asks about me, tell them I have fallen ill. I stuffed some pillows under the blankets of my bed to look like a human. You can sleep there if you miss me. Fourth, if you run out of food, call the Jehovah's Witness mujer I told you about. When Penelope was left alone, she built forts out of cardboard and duct tape. She painted birds on the walls of the fort and proceeded to build a nest from vines, fallen leaves, flowers forced from the earth, and a blanket with La Virgen de Guadalupe quilted into each square of the mass. Her mama never explained these disappearances. When she showed up with gifts and loud stories. Stories about finding maps into other dimensions. Stories about seeing Jesus and Ganesha and Buddha on multiple foods, on mangoes, limes, on bread, on floating bubbles in a mimosa, in ripples of water during the last sun shower. The gods and the star eaters and the holy microscopic organisms of creation are always around. You should have been born in the temple. You should have been born to avenge my past lives. This is what her mama shouted and spat at her after she returned from what Penelope imagined was a blue abyss. Her mother came back with different hair colors or no hair on her head at all. Sometimes she came back and demanded to be left alone. She left the house while Penelope slept and came back home with materials to build altars. She made altars to family members who were long gone. She made an altar for the cucarachas she smashed during her childhood. She offered them crumbs of pan dulce and lit a stubby candle for them. On the mornings where sleep paralysis transports her back into the temple, Penelope wakes up and lights candles for her mother. She's gone for now, and Penelope isn't sure when she will see her next. While she was numb inside of the temple, a man appeared to her. He had gray strips of hair combed over his shining head. He wore all black, and his fingers were drenched in deep blue up to the knuckles. He filled the temple with seawater and octopi. Penelope didn't recognize him, but her mother whispered into her ear before the water passed her ears and eyes. Penelope woke up and sprinted out of her house in pajamas and tears. She ran until her legs wobbled and shook violently. She stopped and curled her body into a park bench as her lungs screamed at her to catch her breath. She overheard two men talking to each other about El Teposteco, the temple that overlooks the city of Morelos, Mexico. This was a temple her mama often talked about. This is where Penelope met the man her mother feared more than anything on the planet. Penelope found the man who raised her mother outside of a gas station waiting for a greyhound to take him into another city. She sat next to him and then grabbed his shoulder. I can either dump your body into the ocean or you can sacrifice yourself to the stars. His frail frame jolted out of Penelope's grasp, but he said nothing. Penelope dug her fingers into his shoulder. I do not care if you are a bag of skin and bones decomposing underground. If you run, I will find you, and I will ensure your final burial is not up to you. His days could no longer be up to him. Inside El Teposteco, Penelope's mama showed her the moments of aggression and the history imprinted into her by this man, the fear he filled into her veins. He mauled her, he cut her, he dragged her. Penelope's mother could not forget this horrific man, but he moved on and had another family in the desert. Her mother's vendetta had to be resolved because Penelope had a seed of her own, a seed she did not want to pass this path of vengeance to. She was in her first trimester, but she already knew the name of the child. She would not tell a soul until after this frail man was gone. He got on his knees and cried at her feet. Penelope slapped him and then dragged him into the car. She blindfolded the man as she walked him into an empty church afterwards. She kicked his back and he cried as his knees hit the ground. Ask for forgiveness. He said nothing, so Penelope kicked him in the gut. Ask for forgiveness. He grasped at the air toward the crucifix and cried. In between labored breathing, he wheezed. I am sorry. Please forgive me. Please, please, please. Penelope grabbed his white hair and slammed his head against the body of Christ. The man fell onto the ground and the giant crucifix fell onto him. Penelope pulled a glass jug of pulque from the car. Chug some, and then poured it over the body of the old man. She dedicated his body to the old gods, the ones who came before a blue-eyed Jesus and before the colonization of women like her. And that's it for that one.
Wow. Damn.
Damn.
I'm telling you what, I grew up in the Catholic Church, and I mean, I'm a recovering Catholic, and now I'm never going anywhere near that. That blew me away. Wow.
God damn.
Wow.
I'm gonna,
you gotta live
my
in
desk
Miami
and cry.
You gotta like live in Miami to get all the different cultural implications going on between, you know, voodoo and Santeria and Catholicism and everything else. Oh my God, that was amazing.
Thank you.
I'm exhausted. That's great.
Well, thanks for that, Rios. That was fucking awesome. That leads to a question. I mean, clearly your background dictates a lot of what's in your work. You have a lot of that culture deeply ingrained in there, and it's not something overt. It's something that, I mean, as I'm listening to you read, I know I come from a Puerto Rican background, but there's something there that's always like it's bone deep that I identify with, even though it's not exactly the same, you know?
Right.
So I guess my biggest question is, you know, there's a lot of emotion there. Does that emotion drive the story more than those themes, or how are you approaching that when you put a story like this together?
I mean, you know, I think it's both, but I'm definitely, when I write, I'm very emotionally invested in whatever characters I create. So if I'm writing something, you know, I feel for whatever character I guess I'm most empathizing for. So in this case, it is Penelope's mother. So when I write, I cry and I get really sweaty, and it's just like this whole like ordeal with my body. Another part for me is just all my stories, all the stories that I have written, they've all been from perspectives of women, but they've also just been perspectives of women who are Chicana or women who are Chapina. So Chicana's from, you know, Mexico, and then Chapina's from Guatemala. And that's just something that I've always written into my stories, and it's something that, eventually I'm sure I'll challenge myself and try to write outside of that perspective, but it's always something that I've been passionate about putting down on paper just to put that voice out there.
How do all your pieces use, what I really enjoy the most is your use of Spanglish and your use of just jimmying in the Spanish, and compliment to that. I mean, you do it in a way too that's context sensitive. I'm a native Spanish speaker, but at the same time, I don't think a person who wouldn't be would be have trouble understanding what you're portraying. Is that something you always try to inject in there as well?
I mean, it depends on the story. So sometimes I will just put it in there because I do think Spanish gives a particular kind of rhythm into the way that I write. But there are some stories where I put no Spanish in at all, just because I don't feel like it's something that the character wouldn't think that way. But for me, it just depends on the rhythm of certain sentences. That's when I decide to put it in there.
That's a good point, because, right, you know, when you speak Spanish, there's almost like a melody to it, and it has a good juxtaposition when you deal with dark subject matter, where you bring in these words that sound more harmonious than they actually really are, right?
Right, yeah. Yeah,
awesome.
Exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Rios. What do you have coming up? Do you have any new releases?
So right now I'm just working on a lot of little projects for anthologies. Starting in April, I'm just going to call them mini hiatuses, because I'll probably go back to Facebook every once in a while. But I'm going to start working on a novel. That's going to be my next goal for the next couple of years, is just working on a full-length novel.
Awesome. Wow. Best of luck with it.
Thank you so much. And thank you for having me.
Thank you so much
for
joining us, Rios. Anytime.
Yeah, of course.
Okay, guys, we're coming in on the end. We have our last reader. A little bit of nepotism, one of my fellow editors at Shotgun Honey, Jen Conley. Now, Jen Conley's short stories have appeared in Thuglit, Needle, a magazine of noir, Crime Factory, Beat to a Pulp, Protectors, Pulp Modern, Trouble in the Heartline, which was crime fiction inspired by the songs of Bruce Springsteen, and many, many others. She's contributed to the Los Angeles Review of Books and is one of the editors of Shotgun Honey with me. Her short story collection, coming very soon, Cannibals, Story from the Edge of the Pine Barrens, will be published by Down and Out Books this summer. Check that out. I am super hyped for it. I may have a Moby in my email inbox now. Born and raised in New Jersey, she's still valiantly, that is, I think that's as low-key as you can make it, lives there. Follow her over on Twitter at JenConley45. Jen, what is up?
Hey, how you doing?
How's it going? I feel like I haven't seen you in forever.
I know. Friday
right?
Night, right?
just some background. Jen and I had a little impromptu reading Saturday night over at KGB Bar at the provocation of Scott Adlerberg, so we were getting drunk together. Jen, what are you reading for us tonight?
I'm going to read something a little older, but it's in my short story collection, and it's kind of short, so I thought it would be perfect, you know, for this.
It's
called June. So I don't know. Have you heard me read this before? You might have.
I think I have.
I don't think I've read it, so I'm interested to hear it.
Okay. All right. This is called June. June, wearing a worn yellow eyelet dress, sat in front of the radio, listening to the Velvets sing A Needle in a Haystack, the music almost drowned out by the noise coming from the bedroom, her mother and Mr. Gash back there, wood bed frame banging against the wall, the grunts from him. The apartment was small, just the bedroom and the front room, a kitchenette off to the side. The men came by, not often, but they came, and in the past, June would go outside and play in the dirt lot next to the building. Today she didn't. She was getting older, figuring things out, and these men in their dungarees or slacks, always with wrinkled shirts, cigarettes hanging from their mouths, they arrived at all hours, sometimes standing in the kitchenette, taking a nip of whiskey before disappearing into the bedroom with her mother. Once, June overheard Mrs. Lamstock, the landlady, talking with Mr. Pratt, who lived below. "It ain't no business of mine what she does," the woman said, "as long as she pays the rent." Mr. Gash carried a leather wallet, and at the moment it sat on the small card table where June and her mother ate their meals. The banging kept going, and the girl moved her ear closer to the radio. She tried to think of other things, like a piece of chocolate cake from the bakery on the main street, or watching television at Betty Ketcher's house, or learning about colonial times in school from her teacher. But none of it removed the thought that Mr. Gash was in the bedroom, that his dented-up car sat in front of the building, everyone knowing why he was there. She turned around, stared at the card table, her eyes finding the wallet. She knew there was money in it, probably with other things like crinkled photographs of his girlfriend or his wife, maybe his kids. She didn't know much about Mr. Gash. "He came from another place," her mother said. "I don't know where he lives. Don't care much." June hadn't eaten since the day before, but there was nothing in the apartment. Her mother had promised that after Mr. Gash left, she'd take her down to the market and they'd buy a chicken and a couple of potatoes. The girl's stomach ached terribly and she licked her lips, thinking that the bakery may be open still, that maybe with a little money, she'd be able to buy her something, perhaps a roll. Carefully, June stood up, the banging from the bedroom thrashing in fast, steady beats. Boom, boom, boom. And she crept to the card table, picked up the wallet, opened it. Her breath stopped when she noticed the bills. So many ones, fives, tens. She pulled the money out, looked at it, thought of all the things she could buy. A whole cake, several rolls, a record player. She placed the wallet down, folded up the cash in her hands, and turned for the door. But the banging suddenly stopped, followed by a great long howl. June froze, her brain trying to think. Stay or go. When he finished, Mr. Gash always emerged from the bedroom rather quickly, half-dressed, shoes untied, shirt unbuttoned, belt unhooked and hanging from his waist. There's no way she could get down the 3 flights of wooden stairs and make a run for it through the streets. So she returned to her spot on the floor in front of the radio, her legs crossed Indian style, her back facing the bedroom door. The song had long moved to something else, Elvis maybe. But she wasn't hearing it. The money was in her hand, and she straightened the bills out and shoved them underneath the rug. The bedroom door opened. "Turn that noise down," Mr. Gash barked. June immediately obeyed, reaching up, moving the knob so the music was lower, keeping her back to the man. She heard him walking along the floorboards, coughing, groaning like he had some terrible ache, muttering about more whiskey. She heard the pouring of the drink, his gulp, the glass hitting the metal counter by the sink. June stared at the small rise in the carpet where the bills were hidden. Any moment he'd realize his money was gone. "What's this?" he said. June kept steady. "What the hell is this?" he said again, and June felt the floor shake as he walked towards her. In a second, his untied brown shoes were inches away from her face. "You take my money?" "No," she said, keeping her eyes down. "Girl, you look at me." June hesitantly turned and peered up at him. He was staring down at her like a beast, holding his wallet, his face pink and raw, glistening with sweat. "Where's my money?" She shook her head. "I don't know." "Bullshit, you do know." I don't." "What, you blaming it on your mom then? You saying she stole it?" "No." "Then you stole it, didn't you?" "No." June saw her mother, wearing a gray satin robe, appear from the bedroom. Her hair was messy and she was barefoot. "What's the matter?" she asked, padding across the room and standing next to Mr. Gash. "Your kid took my money," he said. She placed her hands on her hips. "Is he right?" "No," June whimpered. "You go in his wallet?" She said nothing, just sat on the floor looking up at her mother. "Tell me." Finally, June answered. "Yes." Like the snap of a whip, June's mother lunged forward, snatched her daughter by the arm, and wrenched her up. June tried to squirm away, but her mother had a firm hold. She grabbed June by the mouth and squeezed so hard the girl's teeth hurt. "You show me now." June pointed to the small bump in the carpet. Immediately, Mr. Gash bent down, flung the rug over, and grabbed his money. The woman let go of her daughter's face and pushed the child away. June rubbed her mouth with her hand. Both watched Mr. Gash count the dollars. "I'm missing $10, he said. "No, you ain't," cried June. "I didn't hide it anywhere else." Mr. Gash shoved the money in his wallet and stomped across the room towards the front door. "June," her mother hollered, "where's the rest?" The girl shook her head. "I didn't hide the money anywhere else, just there, under the rug." The woman studied her daughter for a long moment before turning to Mr. Gash. "She ain't lying, Al. I could see it in her face." Mr. Gash sucked on his lips, shrugged. "You got to pay, Al, you know that." He opened the front door. "No, I don't." "Al, you owe me money." Mr. Gash ignored June's mother and left, slamming the door behind him. "Al," she screamed. "God damn it, you no good son of a bitch." And she swung around and turned her rage on her daughter. "You think that radio gets played by air? You think money grows on the goddamn trees?" June began to weep. "Damn girl, now we got nothing, nothing." She beat June across the face with an open hand. One hit, another. Later, her mother fixed soup from a can, something she went up and got from Mr. Pratt down below, and made June sit at the table and watch her eat it. June's face was still sore from the beating, pain shooting into the top of her head, but it was her stomach that hurt more. How hungry she was. With each slurp, her mother hummed, smiled, licked her teeth. "Oh, so tasty," she crooned. She finished every last bit and made her daughter wash the bowl. That's it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
kind of waiting for that reaction. As you guys can see, Jen Conley is scary.
I am blown away.
One of the reasons, June is definitely one of my favorites of yours, Jen, and I guess one of my first questions, I don't think I've ever really asked you, is just how do you manage to get so goddamn black, man? You get dark. And the times I've heard some of your stories, I'm just like, oh, you need to, like, go drink another beer, roll up in bed, cry for a while.
Sorry about that.
No, it's fine. I'll be okay. But when you're putting these stories together, is it that you're trying? Do you tell yourself, is this the natural place to go, or do you try to find a way to get there?
Well, first of all, I have a demented mind to begin with, and I always liked horror stuff. You know, when I was younger, and I think I like honestly, I think I like to see. I think I'm upset a lot by the inhumane things in the world, so I think I sort of write about inhumane things. You know, like, I think June is actually a story of teaching her daughter how they survive. You know what I mean? It's a lesson that she's teaching her daughter. You know what I mean? It's a cruel lesson, but it's a necessary lesson. So it's almost a humane, like a little bit of humanity in this, I guess.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like dark stuff, and I think I usually am trying. I guess I am just looking to figure out not as dark as I can go, because I don't like to exploit things, but I do like to get to the darkness of people, I guess.
And so, almost, you know, I've said, I think we've had the talk where I think empathy feeds a lot into crime fiction, where I don't think you can write about some of this stuff without actually feeling bad about it. It's not like we're sitting here going, ha, 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 take that character. It's more like we kind of have this bizarre understanding of how screwed up this stuff is. But maybe, I don't know, somehow that makes it easier to write sometimes, right? It's weird.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know. Like, my short story collection is called Cannibals, and I came up with this short story called Cannibals, and it was about a girl who comes upon a homeless camp. And the reason why I came up with it, because every day I would drive by a homeless camp and I would go to work, a huge, giant one, and I would just see these people, and they lived in the woods, and my heart went out to them, but I was also scared of them at the same time. It was just this weird mixture of feelings every day. So sometimes it's what I see, what I read, you know, things like that. So, I mean, usually it's got to, like, bother me. So that's probably it. So,
thank you so much for reading, Jen. That's definitely one of my favorites of yours. Thanks for stopping by.
Thanks.
All right, guys, we've got a little time left. We're going to open the phone lines now. It's 347-633-9609. If you guys have any questions for our readers or me, make me tertiary, please, give a call. Do we have anybody on yet, Pam? Or
not yet. I'll let you know.
Come on, cool people. All right, while we wait... Let's
I have a question for Rios. I'm still like kind of weirded out about that story. There's so much symbolic stuff in there, and I love what Angel had asked you about Spanglish, because growing up in Miami, you know, I understood everything you said, and we have this mix of cultures and everything. Do you intentionally use the symbols of religion in your work, or is it just in this particular story?
I use symbols of religion quite often, just because I grew up with a lot of the symbols as a child, and so I write a lot about La Virgen de Guadalupe. Like, she's in a lot of the stories. I write a lot about blue-eyed Jesus as well.
I'm sure.
That's something that pops up quite a bit. And it's just from, I like to interject, little bits of how white supremacy and colonization, how that's affected religion. And
sure has.
I like to interject that sort of thing into into my stuff as well. And I just really love the symbolism of La Virgen. It's just one of my favorite. She's just one of my favorite just symbols ever. So it's quite often.
It's really fascinating. I read a lot of books, as Angel knows, but I've never heard a story like that. And when you finish your book, you have to put my name on your list of people to call and let me know, because I definitely want to read it. But more than that, I'd love to have you come back on. All of you are spectacular. This is just so right up my alley because of how I grew up. I mean,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah, absolutely.
My first husband was a blue-eyed blonde, and then the second one was a Mexican guy. So trust me, I get all the weird things that are going on, you know. I love it all. It's
absolutely.
Great. It's great. And I've read all of you, because I read Shotgun Honey all the time, so I'm familiar with all of your work. I thought you all were just brilliant. I have to tell you, I've so much enjoyed it. Can I tell you more than the guys that are really on Throwdown? I love them all, but the dames really rock.
The war begins.
The dames rock it, and you're a perfect host for it, Angel. I have to tell you that. We're waiting for calls at 347-633-9609. The first person who calls is going to get a gift certificate from me for Amazon. So you can go and read some of this really great flash from all these wonderful authors that are on here. I'll send you a gift card through either email for your Kindle or whatever. But let's give it a ring. In the meantime, Angel, I'm turning it back over to you, okay?
Thanks, fam. All right, I'll throw out an open question there, guys. Is there, you can chime in when you want. Is there any genres that you guys haven't touched that you sometimes think about, be it horror, romance, space dystopian, cyberpunk, whatever? Is there anything out there that you guys have ever just haven't tried yet or think about trying, or you have a file someplace that's like, yeah, I'll never talk about that ever?
I actually tried. This is Renee, by the way. I actually tried to write an erotic romance that 2 years ago. And it was almost funny in the way that about halfway through it just got really dark and depressing. And I was like, well, this is never going to work. Like, I'm just not capable of giving it the happy ending that the reader wants.
So there was no like sudden revelation and now like, oh man, we're going to hug so hard. It was more like,
yeah, like
knives
just,
came out.
Yeah. Not knives. Like, I knew what genre.
I mean, I'm sure that
could
be some kind of erotic romance. But
Well, there's Rule 34. There's something for everybody, right?
Right. The rule of the genre, though, is that it has to have a happy ending. And when I got to the point where, like, everyone was, like, dying, I was like, it's probably, that's not going to happen.
Oh, no, sudden cancer. Does anybody
okay,
else, any of you guys have anything?
I'm gonna take a call right here for you. Let's see. Oh. Area code 510. Who's this?
This is Rob.
Hello?
Pierce.
Oh, this guy.
Rob Pierce.
Yeah. I don't want anything free. I want to give people money. But I just wanted to say hi to Angel, and I thought everyone was great except Renee, because she's just...
Right.
I'm not even going to continue swearing at her anymore.
Rob, tell everybody who you are, dear, so people know.
What about ADR? ADR, all the back issues are available. They just don't do the magazine anymore. The latest book they had released until today was the terrific novella couplet by Marietta Miles, who I believe is going to be on a Dames episode soon. So,
yeah, she's hosting a Dames episode, actually.
What?
She's hosting.
Marietta's hosting one.
Hosting a Dames episode. She'll do
a piece, but
she's also the host, huh?
Yeah, one more really nice person who writes really dark shit.
since those old ADRs are available, like I definitely recommend folks pick those up. Issue one with Renee's story is unbelievable. And, I mean, issues 3 and 5 are pretty good. I may have been in those, but, you know, I mean, aside from my stuff, there's good stuff in there.
Yeah. So we're talking about all due respect for those of you who are, like, living under a rock and don't know this genre. That would be Bob, so. Rob,
yeah, but they're my publisher, so I pay attention.
There you go. I'm glad you called in. You want to hang out for a little bit? We've got, about 8 minutes left on the show. Anything you want
to
say?
I'd love to listen if someone smart will talk.
No,
oh,
I'll tell you what.
Come on, this is crime fiction, buddy.
That rules me out, sorry.
Well, don't use big words or anything.
Well, all right, so what's up next for everybody? What's everybody doing next? Let's start at the top. Angel Luis Colón, tell me what's going on with you.
I had a baby, so there's that. Second baby.
You didn't.
I mean, it's not like I don't post pictures. So I've got
cute
that going
to be,
on. So,
too.
Thank
cute
you.
Titty.
She's awesome. It's a fucking revelation. compared to the first one, I never slept with the first one. This one's awesome. But in the meantime, my agent and I are trying to sell my first book, Hell Chose Me. Hopefully that'll happen at some point. I've got another book that I just gave to him that is my attempt at mainstream thriller. So that'll be fun.
Cool.
I've got later on this year from Down and Out, I've got the previously mentioned No Happy Endings coming out. It's a little bit of a riff on Thief, starring an Asian-American safecracker, female at that. So I'm hoping folks
Ooh.
Enjoy that. The initial log line for it was Death by Bukkake, but it's not as bad as you think.
Oh.
We folks really enjoy it. I will, spoilers, a woman does not die by Bukkake. It's definitely a guy.
Okay.
That was a step too far. I was like, let me not piss everybody off. So I'm looking forward to that one. I'm actually currently also in the middle of writing the latest Blackie Jaguar. So
yes.
Hopefully that goes all right. Yeah.
All right. Nikki, what's going on with you? What are you doing next?
Trying to write something new, really. I cleared out all my backlog last year, and now I'm like, I need something for this Dames in the Dark. Okay, gotta write something. So
cool.
This is the new thing I've written.
I like it. It was really good.
Ass.
This is fun. Renee?
Much like Nikki, I was literally about 10 minutes before the show started making final edits on this story. But I forgot to mention at the beginning, so a while back, I got to do an issue of a comic book called Trista and Holt, which is a noir comic book. And the main guy behind that, Andres Bergen, novelized it. And he managed to get that picked up by an indie here in the U.S. So hopefully, very soon, I'm going to have news on where you can buy that novel that's based on the work we did on the comic. And it's a really cool gender-flipped version of the Tristan and Isolde myth in the gangland 70s in the UK. So it's all like disco and crime and all kinds. And it's great.
I'm jealous.
That's awesome.
That's exciting. I'm almost
so cool.
Crazy. So I've got to write that down.
Yeah, and you can get the digital versions of the comic in the U.S., but right now, like, the hard versions are only in Australia, but the novel will be out soon, and he told me that it ends a little bit differently than in the comic, so there's a reason to have both.
Mm.
So, wink.
Good. Heather, what's going on with you, Heather?
I got a couple of things going on. It's sort of funny that everybody was talking about writing pieces for tonight, because I, in fact, started one and was almost finished, and then took it upon myself in the last few days to try to get back into exercising. And I've been taking a boxing class. And my hands have been shaking so badly that I can't type.
Oh, geez.
So I was not able to finish the piece. For a minute when I first got home, I thought I was having a stroke.
Didn't anyone ever tell you, you just get two buckets of ice water and stick your hands in there after boxing? That'll help.
Well, I'm serious. Clearly, I discovered that I was that out of shape. That sitting behind a desk apparently is not good enough. So I didn't get to finish the new piece. But I have a recent piece that came out in Manslaughter Review. I've got a couple of short pieces I'm working on. I'm in the process of writing a second novel, which is set in the Ozark Mountains and is a crime novel. Does not have a name yet. And then I'm kind of doing a a ghostwriting co-authoring thing on the side right now of a political thriller of all things. So I'm lucky enough to spend all day long writing, but I got a lot of irons in the fire.
As long as it's noir on that political thing, I'm happy. Carmen, what are you doing?
So let's see. About a month ago, I finished and submitted a short story. And full disclosure, it was rejected. So I'm now, like, since it's like been a month, I'm going back through it, and I'm just like, okay, yeah, this could actually be better. So I'm gonna work on cleaning that up a bit before I do anything else with it. I'm going back to
Bad from rejections. It's all rejections are just a learning opportunity,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Good for you.
Now that I lose some, I'm getting to read it again. I was like, yeah, you know, this really could be better. There's more stuff I could do now, especially now that I've had some time to think about it, not stare at it every day for like a month and a half. And then other than that, I'm spent like devoting another chunk of time to working on a novel that I've been doing for a couple of years now, I think. It takes place in Minnesota in the wintertime.
So. Florida girl here, can't handle it. A lot of good motivation, though, right? Fargo and everything else, or is that Wisconsin? No, it's Minnesota. Jen,
Jen? Sorry.
Yeah, Jen.
I have a short story collection coming out with Down and Out Books, you know, Cannibals and other stories. Yeah, I said that
get
already.
In touch with me so I can read it and send some of our book reviewers on it, too, okay?
Yeah,
you know
well, it's coming out May 16th, so it's soon.
Okay.
So I've got to get on this, and I'm just about finished with. Well, I have editing to do, but I'm working on a horror novel. So kind of like horror, but it's more leaning toward for women, if that makes any sense. Kind of like.
Well, let me tell you something. There's in the same network where I am. There's a really popular horror show. Radio talk show. I mean, they're the people from The Walking Dead and Dexter and all that kind of crap. They're always on there. So when you're ready, let me know, okay? We're out of time for tonight. We're out of time. I want to say thank you again to Angel Luis Colon for being the best ever Dames in the Dark host, and to all the fantastic dames who are here, and Rob Pierce, who are here tonight. talk to you. Don't forget Skid Row Chatter with Tom Pitts tomorrow night with Joe R. Lansdale. It's going to be fun. Thank you so much. Have a really great night, everyone, and thanks for being here. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for kicking ass. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.